This is Alexander Jones Live today, Thursday the 14th of March. On this edition, there is a new Pope. We find out what this means for Catholics around the world. After last week's student elections, we question why St Andrews has the highest turnout in the UK. After 5.30, the woman fundraising for a Hamish McCamish statue is here. And finally, we will discuss the current crisis in Bulgaria. That's all here on Alexander Jones Live. And don't forget, if you don't already do so, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Mr. Jones News. Yesterday, Pope Francis I was elected. He's the first pope to take the name Francis, the first Jesuit to become a pope, and the first South American. So quite a change, or is it? I'm joined by Cole Matson, who's from the Catholic Society and is a PhD student at St. Mary's here in St. Andrews. Welcome to the programme, Cole. Thanks for joining us. So, how much of a change do you really think that Francis will be for the Church?
I don't think he'll be a particularly large change. I mean, one thing that all the cardinals, you know, have been chosen by previous popes, specifically so that there isn't a huge new direction, the Church doesn't veer to left and to the right all over the place. So I imagine it's more continuity with previous popes.
Yeah, so you think that although he's already made quite a stance, so first to take the name Francis, is that sending a symbol that he wants to be different?
I really enjoy the fact that he took the name Francis, and it is Francis of Assisi and not Francis Xavier, as some people have been discussing. I did read a notice saying that he explicitly did say, "I take this name Francis after Francis of Assisi because of his love for the poor." And I think that is one thing that is a benefit of this current pope, that he, in his history, has emphasized humility, has emphasized being one of the people, has emphasized taking care of the poor, and of course that is one of the priorities of the Church, and really is the priority of the Church. I mean, a lot of people, when they think of the Church, they think of hot-button political issues, but really, those are secondary to care for the poor.
So we're going to see a lot more social justice as the focus of the Catholic Church?
I really hope so, and I really hope we get to a point where social justice isn't a bad word. Yeah.
He's quite an old candidate for Pope, 76. Do you think that we'll see him retiring in a few years' time? Is he a short-term choice?
Well, if you read The Onion today, you'll see that he's already retired. I mean, if you don't know, The Onion is a satire newspaper, and that was today's headline, that he'd already retired. It was odd to me that they had chosen someone who was just a bit younger than Ratzinger when he was elected. I don't expect that he'll retire anytime soon, if he does retire. So I hope that we'll have him for many more years.
Yeah. And he's a Jesuit as well?
Yes.
That's the other thing. What do you think of that? That sounds like excitement in your voice.
I love it. I literally leapt for joy when they announced that last night. I became a Catholic because of the Jesuits. I was catechized by the Jesuits. I've worked with Jesuits. I've been instructed by Jesuits. I love the Jesuits. So I'm very happy. And Jesuits all over the U.S., which is where I'm from, have been, you know, shaking their heads in bafflement, but jumping for joy at the fact that one of their brothers has become Pope. Ignatius, of course, the founder of the Jesuits, never wanted any of his men to become even bishops, much less, I think, in a way, he might have been rolling in his grave to think that one of them could become Pope. But as American Jim Martin wrote in an article today, that Ignatius is probably smiling because the fact that this election of Francis as Pope appears to be for the greater glory of God, one of the Jesuits' mottos. So I think in the end, Ignatius would be happy, and I know the other Jesuits are happy.
So maybe for those of us on the outside of the Church, could you just briefly explain what the fact that he's a Jesuit means that's different about what he does as a Catholic?
Yes, well, the Jesuits are the largest men's religious order in the Catholic Church, and the thing about the Jesuits is that they're about doing whatever serves the greater glory of God, and the vow that they take that's specific to them is to go wherever the Pope sends them. And so they're all about being available for whatever mission they're called to. They've also been known as being social justice is one of their priorities, education is one of their priorities. It takes twice as long to train a Jesuit as it does to train a member of any other religious order. So one of the things that Jesuits will be saying about this Pope is they might not know much about him, but they'll know that he's gone through the spiritual exercises of St. Loyola, of St. Ignatius of Loyola. So they'll know that his spirituality is about being available to whatever God calls him to do and being open to finding God in all things.
You mentioned before that when the Jesuits were founded, they would never even become bishops, let alone Pope. one of the things that I heard last night is that the Jesuits have always been quite keen to avoid getting people into senior positions because they thought that the individual would get the credit and the movement would get the blame for anything they did wrong.
I know that one of the reasons Ignatius didn't want his men to become pope is because he didn't like the idea of sort of social climbing. You know, I become a priest so I can become a bishop, so I can become an archbishop, so I can become a cardinal, so I can become pope. You know, this prince of the church in power. He wanted his men to be humble and poor. And so one of the things I've completely lost the train of thought. Remind me of the question again that you just asked.
The Jesuits, what difference will it make for him?
For him, it will be the fact that they didn't want to become bishops.
Yeah.
I think Ignatius sort of didn't want his men to go searching for power. He wanted them to be where the poor and the working people on the margins. So for him, I think probably the reason he was a good choice is because he was one of the last people on earth who would want to become pope. I read that at the last conclave, he was second behind Ratzinger, and that at that conclave, he pleaded with the cardinals in tears, "Please do not elect me." And Jesuits, if they're asked to take positions of power like bishops, they traditionally refuse. And often they have to be asked over and over and over until finally they say yes, because it's clear that they've been asked to serve in this role. So I wonder if in the conclave last night, you know, the dean of the College of Cardinals had to say, you know, "Will you accept? No. Will you accept? No. Will you accept? No. Will you accept, please? Okay." I imagine that might have happened.
That's quite an interesting angle and one that I've not heard so far today. Because actually, in many ways, a lot of the coverage that I've heard has been pointing towards the fact that he's been waiting, that he came second last time, and that this has been, I've had to wait for 7-8 years, and now it's my time. But you're suggesting it's the complete opposite.
That, from what I've read about him and from what I saw last night, and from what I know of Jesuits, I would sense it would be the complete opposite, that this was the last thing in the world he would have wanted, but that he's happy to serve if... It's been clear that his fellow cardinals want him to serve and think he's the best suited for this role.
Okay, the final difference that makes him stand out from previous popes, he's the first non-European in over 1,000 years and the first from South America, in fact, the first from the Americas at all.
Yeah.
What do you think that'll mean for the church?
I was actually hoping that we'd get somebody sort of from outside of Europe, and I actually wasn't hoping for an American, but I was hoping we'd get somebody good from Africa or Latin America. Because the Catholic Church has shifted, Christianity worldwide is shifted to the global South, and especially World Youth Day is coming up in Brazil this summer, where millions of youth from around the world meet. I imagine that's going to be a huge celebration there. But I'm glad that it's showing that, you know, the Church isn't just about old Western civilization in Europe, you know, spread to the U.S. It's in Canada. It's universal. I mean, the word Catholic means universal. That's a universal church, and good men and women exist everywhere that the church is, not just in the historical bastions of Christianity.
It's quite interesting that you're so positive, and so many of the people that I meet here are really positive about it, because this is the power balance moving away from the West, and particularly from Europe, towards the South. Do you find any European Catholics feel threatened by this?
I haven't spoken to any who have felt threatened, and of course, most of my European Catholic friends are British Catholic friends, so I don't know very much about how, you know, continental European Catholics would feel about this. But I wouldn't imagine that too many people really would feel threatened, because the Church is such a universal Church, and that's such a big, important part of how we act and our faith. So there might be a sense of, you know, what's going to happen if Europe isn't in control of the papacy. But I think that's a good thing. That's actually freeing for us to find out, you know, what the Holy Spirit can do when it's separated, when the papacy is separated from historical Europe.
Of course, it's stressed as a good thing that he comes from Latin America, and the Church, people like to keep pointing out, is growing there. But actually, one of the things that again has come over is actually how the Catholic Church is no longer growing in the rate it was, and because the evangelical form of Christianity appears to be taking more of the followers away from that. Is that going to be a concern for the new pope to address?
I think it definitely would be. I mean, he'd be very familiar with the distribution of Christianity in Latin America and his area of the world. So I think it is probably going to be something, of course, that he'd be thinking about, you know, how to address. Is there something that people are finding in other forms of Christianity that they should be finding in Catholicism but aren't? Like an emphasis on the role of the Spirit and taking the Spirit seriously. So yes, I think that will be a concern for him.
I heard last night he took the bus with the other cardinals, and apparently he took the bus to work before as well. Are we going to see the Pope on the bus more often?
You know, I think as much as he can get away with it, you know, hopefully. If anyone has read Les Miserables, I mean, he reminds me very much of Monsignor Bienvenu, who, in the story, you know, when he became bishop, moved out of the huge bishop's palace and gave it to the hospital, which he needed more beds, and took the little house next to it. And, I mean, that's, in a way, what Pope Francis did when he was Archbishop of Buenos Aires. He didn't live in the huge palace. He lived in a little apartment across the street from his church, you know, because he didn't need all that. He wanted to remain humble. And the fact that he did all that, you know, and this is, you know, years and years before he was ever considered as Pope. This is way before 2005. That seems to be a genuine part of who he is, and not trying to play humble, that he genuinely is humble, which is very exciting.
And how far do you think he's going to get with these ideas in the Vatican? This is all quite radical stuff. I can't see them letting him move out of the Vatican into an Italian apartment instead.
Yeah, I imagine he'll probably stay in the Vatican because, you know, there's also the importance of symbol and stability. It'll be interesting to see, you know, what boundaries he tries to push in terms of, you know, the formalities. But really, those formal things, you know, where do you live, you know, what clothes do you wear, do you bring back the red slippers or not, like Ratzinger did. Those are just things on the surface. One thing that is really important is I really, really hope that he'll emphasize the importance of the poor and not only dealing with individual sin, but systemic sin. And structures in society that cause us to harm one another, and how can we not only individually become more caring for the poor, but as a society and as a world, genuinely serve the poor in our neighborhoods and in other parts of the world. So I'm hoping that deeper issue of change of focus will be something that he takes up.
Is he going to get worn down quite quickly with the Vatican bureaucracy and struggle to reform it?
You know, I don't know, because I don't know really anything about his bureaucratic skills. I know that he's obviously a good enough leader that he was chosen superior of the Jesuits and chosen a bishop and chosen an archbishop and now chosen pope.
He's a clear Vatican outsider, though, isn't he?
Yes, yes. So I really don't know how he's going to deal with these sort of entrenched Vatican structures that there have been a lot of complaints about under Pope Benedict. So I really don't know. I'm looking forward to seeing what he does try to do.
Finally, are your views shared by the other Catholics you meet in St. Andrews? What's everyone feeling today?
Well, last night we were certainly extremely excited and all watched his first appearance on the big screen in the church hall at St. James. And today, I mean, the Catholics I've been talking with were still sort of aglow. I think we're all very excited about Pope Francis and to see what happens. So yes, we're still really excited and, you know, thanking God for the election of this, you know, holy man.
Cole Matson, thank you very much for joining us here on Star.
Thanks, Alex. Star.
StAndrewsRadio.com. Hear no evil on StAndrewsRadio.com.
You're listening to Alexander Jones Live on St. Andrew's Radio. And don't forget, you can tweet me. I'm at Mr. Jones News. And if you don't already, make sure to like Star on Facebook for the latest updates from all the presenters on the station. Last week, students in St. Andrew's went to the polls in union elections. Once again, turnout reached 50%, which is sure to be the highest figure in the UK this year. Most universities will struggle to reach half of that. Last year's record turnout of 52% was the highest ever for a student election in the UK, second only to Imperial. Second beneath that, sorry, was Imperial College London, which came next with 41%, over 10% less. So why can St Andrews get such high turnouts? I'm joined by the Director of Representation Elect, Teddy Woodhouse, from Star's very own Teddy Woodhouse. Congratulations.
Thanks so much.
And welcome to the programme. So why is it you think St Andrews can manage such high turnouts compared to everywhere else?
I think one of the big factors for it is the fact that students know other students, and nothing is more powerful in turning voter turnout than having your friends say, can you vote for me in this election, or have you heard about this race? I think the town really does come, you know, alive with a certain kind of buzz during elections week that you don't find at other universities, especially at large universities that just can't kind of sustain that same atmosphere.
See, I'm quite interested that last year, in my first year here, I feel there was a lot more in-your-face advertising of the elections. There were visibly far more people out on the street campaigning, going into the library. You went through a tunnel of people handing out flyers. And there wasn't, to the same extent, that quantity of people out this year, yet the turnout was more or less identical. So, actually, is it about the town, and is it about the way that you can't avoid it there, or is there any other factors that might contribute?
I think one of the important things with kind of talking about the campaigning styles over the 2 years and how to compare the two is last year was the first year we ever did online voting. So there was a large degree of unpredictability from both the candidate side and the voter side on how does this affect the way we elect our sabbatical officers. Whereas this year, people knew much more how the system worked, how, you know, voting pacing worked out over the 2 days of Thursday and Friday, because it was also the first time we'd ever done 2 days of voting rather than just one on paper. So I think that extra degree of predictability made it less hectic for candidates, to say. I think you didn't have the same library gauntlet that you did last year, but you still had candidates out there on a very regular basis, you know, trying to get their name out there.
So do you think that online voting is the key to the success, that it's really easy for people to do it on their own?
Oh, yeah. No, I think it's definitely part of it. Not only just for us, but for other universities who have tried it, you see ginormous changes in the way and trends people are voting and the turnouts. Turnouts will triple, even quadruple in some places because they go to an online voting system because it's so accessible for people at that time. So I think it's definitely something we should have here to stay.
What sort of turnouts were we getting here before that? Have you any idea what they were?
I can't say I precisely know what the turnout was here like. I'm trying to think of an example that I remember reading the numbers of both before and after, but nothing's coming to my head right now.
But significantly lower.
Oh, yeah, it was significantly lower. I think, you know, your average student election will bring in somewhere between 10 to 20% of the student vote, if you're lucky on that. That's still pretty high numbers for a paper election. But if you go to online student elections, much more trend towards the 30, 40, sometimes, if you're like us, 50%.
St. Andrews, 50.
Yeah.
So how do you think this can be maintained in the coming year? You're director of representation-elect, so it's going to be your responsibility to keep people engaged in the elections process. How will you ensure the same or even a better turnout next year?
Yeah, my target for next year is definitely hitting that 50% mark again. I think it's a great thing for us to have as an institution to say we're the only UK place to do it once, and we're now aiming to do it a third time in history. So I think that's great if we can do it again. From my role as kind of direct representation in the year ahead, I hope to do more with kind of the SA Elect team and also promoting it within the institution of, you know, getting out there to vote. How do you vote? Why should you vote? What's the importance of voting? So it's not just the emphasis on the candidates to convince people to vote. I think the Students' Union should be doing more about that as well.
We say that we've got 50%, which might be a lot better than many other universities, but that's still 50% who didn't vote. Mm. And do you think that they need to be engaged more in student politics? And if so, how can you go about doing that?
Well, I think it's always good to have high turnout rates. I don't think we should ever strive to have 100% turnout rates, because I think there are students who intentionally decide, I don't want to vote, or I don't think we should have the obligation for students to vote. I think it's good that we have a culture of voting in St. Andrews, and it's good to promote that. To really promote it in the year ahead, it is kind of those things of doing more within promoting elections as the Students' Union rather than just the candidates, but also increasing transparency, I think, in our system can also make it more accountable and make people feel like they have a greater stake in it. Because one of the things I campaigned on was adding a demerit system in the way candidates are penalized for breaking rules. In previous years, it's been very hush-hush, and it kind of like the candidate gets talked to with the SA Elect Committee and no one really hears anything else about it. But I think if students know when their candidates are breaking rules or how they're breaking the rules and kind of penalties around that, it becomes more transparent, and students are going to be a little bit more interested because they'll feel like they have more information at their hands on it.
Was this an issue this year? Have there been any candidates that were brought in for breaking the rules?
I know general trends. I don't know specifics because I was a candidate rather than part of the committee, but It was, this year was comparatively quite low in terms of candidates breaking rules, and I think that's a good thing to have for us. But I don't think it necessarily needs to be a reaction. I think we can take action on making the union more transparent in the future.
You mentioned keeping voting optional and that people maybe choose not to vote. There is an option to spoil your ballot paper. Do you think that's something that is good to have on the vote as well?
Yeah, I think students should have like all the options put forward to them. I think it's also important that we have, you know, Ron on the ballot as well. So if a student does...
Ron, who didn't appear on the ballot to start with.
Ron, who didn't appear on the ballot for, I think it was the first 300 students. And I think the way that it was understood is if anyone who particularly wanted to run a candidate in any of the races, they could have held their ballot for a few hours. I think it was in by midday, the first day of voting. They could hold their ballot and then vote and run whoever they wanted to run. So I think, yeah, having those kind of capacities for students to voice their dissent or their, you know, dissatisfaction with a position or a candidate or the way the union's working is valid to have there.
Does this engagement at elections actually translate into a generally engaged student population throughout the year in student politics issues?
I would hope so. I think there is a definite kind of disparity in terms of, you know, you have very high involvement at elections and not so high involvement throughout the rest of the year. So that's one of the things I definitely want to promote in the year ahead and kind of change is giving students more information and more access to better information on what the SRC is doing and what we're doing as an institution throughout the year, so students know exactly what who they voted into and what they're doing.
It is still a relatively small number of students, though, actually, who day-to-day know what goes on in the union, the people engaged in the committees itself and the student media ourselves. So is there any way of actually bringing a larger group into the fold just so that they actually take more than the faintest passing interest?
I think one of the big things we can do, and fortunately this is one of the things that is happening in the year ahead, is we're getting a new website. So it'll be something people actually want to visit on their internet browsers. And I think that's something I know I'm very keen on. Kelsey, who's the DASDA-elect, especially us two, but I think all the SABs are very keen on having this new website and having students be able to be more easily engaged through that website.
One issue, I suppose, that remains still is the unfilled positions. There weren't too many this year, but there are some. What happens now with them?
The way it works, it kind of varies on on what role and its kind of position within the Students Association. But, you know, kind of talking about where my specialty is, which is representation, so I kind of cover the SRC, or Student Representative Council. With those positions, they become carve-ups, and either it's kind of put up by the SRC. They can either hold elections or they can hold elections, or they can just select within the SRC to choose who's going to fill that position for the rest of the year.
What would you like to see them do? Holding elections for the position again, or just appointing someone to them?
I have faith in them to choose what they think is the right thing. I actually don't come in. That process will actually be completed before I come into office, so it's something I'm not directly involved in.
What's your view on the scandal that hit the AU a few weeks ago on their removal of Democracy as the new Director of Representation for the union? Do you think that's the right way forward?
I think it's something that the AU exec that's now outgoing thought was an effective way to change things. And I can totally sympathise with that perspective. I wasn't a personal fan of how they handled the consultation of it, and I'm not a fan of how it was brought in as a system. The system itself, I think, is valid, and there are benefits, clear benefits to it, and I do hope it does bode well for the future of the AU. And talking with Jess, I think she also has some good plans ahead for the AU change as well.
So there's no signs that that will be changed by yourself or Jess, the new AU president?
Well, as far as I know, neither of us have a direct input too much on it. Right now, the status of it is it's going to be put forward to one of the subcommittees in the university court. And on that subcommittee, the main student voice is actually the association president. And it's not me. It's not me as the director representation elect or Jess as the...
It's Freddie, the current president.
Yeah, exactly.
President.
Freddie, the current president. So it's really down to him in kind of voicing the student opinion on this matter.
St Andrews remains quite inward-looking in the bubble here. One of our things that you would maybe expect with a broadly engaged student political population is actually to be looking outside the bubble as well. Do you expect to be involved in more national campaigns over the coming year?
It's something I'm interested in being more involved in, and I think some of the issues that are coming up for students, specifically in St. Andrews, are going to require that. I think Chloe's idea about having a Scottish sabbatical forum and bringing Scottish sabbaticals from St. Andrews, but also from NUS and non-NUS institutions, has the potential to get us more involved in those national issues. One of the things I'm really particularly keen on is, you know, fixing fees for international students, but also the way we deal with our UK tuition fees. And I think those two key issues where we are going to need to be involved beyond St. Andrews are ways we can do that.
Okay, finally, before we get the Star News at 5:30, so you're now elected into position. When do you actually take over?
I'll start having my formal handover process in June, and there's a two-week process where I just shadow Amanda and follow her around. But I officially take the position July 1 with all the others, with the other three Students Association sabbaticals, and then we serve for 1 year.
And have you met up with the other SABs more than for a photo to discuss actually how you're going to go forward now?
Yeah, we have. We've done bits and pieces. We actually had nachos together, I think it was on last Tuesday. So we're getting to, most of us knew each other kind of a little bit already, but, you know, trying to really build a working relationship. And I think all of us are really excited for the year ahead.
And what plans are there for after the summer for your role directly? What will you be doing straight away when you take over?
Straight away, well, one of the things that Amanda started last year, and one of the traditions I'd really like to keep, is having the director of representation meet with each director of teaching in each school. The director of teaching, or DOT, is basically the head staff member who kind of deals with academic affairs and representation. And so kind of building that personal relationship does a lot to promote the class rep system, make sure it's viable and working correctly, and also for school presidents. And I think that's one of my first steps that I have in the summer.
And will you be working alongside school presidents in their representation as well?
Yeah, I'm the line, director of representation is the line manager for school presidents and the class representation system. So yeah, I'm directly involved in that as well.
Thank you very much, Teddy, for coming on the programme, and best wishes for the year ahead. You're listening to Alexander Jones Live here on St Andrews Radio. Coming up in just a few moments, the woman who's suggesting a Hamish McHamish statue is here. She'll be coming to speak to me in just a few moments. And later on, we'll be discussing Bulgarian politics. That's coming up at about 5:45 today. But first, it's 5:30 and time for the latest from Star News.
From Star Studios, this is Star News.
Want to find out more about Star? Then check out standrewsradio.com. standrewsradio.com.
You're listening to Alexander Jones Live here on St. Andrew's Radio. And we move on now to one of St. Andrew's favourite people. Everyone knows him. He can be seen around the town and is loved by residents and students alike. He is, of course, Hamish McCamish. Last year, the town's favourite cat had a book written about him, and now he could have a statue as well. Well, resident Flora Selwyn is behind the project, and she is here in the studio with us. Welcome to the programme, Flora.
Hello, thank you very much.
So, how did this project come about?
Good question. Susan's book was so famous and so well done, I suddenly thought, it came out of the blue actually, that it would be nice to have something in the town which would remember Hamish forever, because he's given so much pleasure to everybody for the last 14 years. And then I've thought about Greyfriars Bobby, who was supposed to have sat on his master's grave for 14 years. So somehow there was a resonance, although it was obviously quite different.
So can you just explain to our listeners what is so special about Hamish?
Very difficult to say. He's a beautiful cat who decided to adopt St. Andrews. It wasn't the other way around. St. Andrews belongs to Hamish, not Hamish to St. Andrews. He left his home, where he had been taken at the age of about 6 months, and took off and gave his favours to anybody he fancied. I think the first time that he wandered, he was found in DRA at 2 o'clock in the morning on somebody's bed, and the student actually phoned Marianne Baird, who officially owns him, to ask why the cat was on her bed. So that started it, and then he went round and bestows his favours on all the shops. He gets welcomed everywhere. He decides where he wants to go, what he wants to do, and people feed him, and everybody knows him, and all the students took to him and put him on Facebook, and he now has 5,000 friends on Facebook, which is
Facebook won't even let me be a friend with him. It says he's got too many.
Really?
Apparently 5,000 is as many as he's allowed.
Oh.
So when did this legend of Hamish grow up? Because for the last couple of years it's clearly been really entrenched as long as I've been here. When did it begin?
Well, he's been around the town for 14 years. He's getting quite elderly, actually. But I saw him in 2006, and I run St. Andrews and Focus magazine, and I saw this beautiful cat sitting in Church Square outside Peter Pizza Express. And somebody opened the door very ceremoniously, and up got Hamish, and up went his tail, and he walked in as if he owned the place. And I thought, well, this cat's obviously got attitude. So I did some research to find out about him. And I've been publishing stories about him ever since. And people as far away as the south of England have emailed me to say, oh, they're so pleased that Hamish is still around and they would like to see him when they come back to St. Andrews. And it's been quite remarkable.
So this project specifically, the statue of Hamish, how much money has been raised so far for this?
We have two ways of getting money. One is crowdfunding through Bloom VC. And the other one, I went into Santander Bank, where I bank, and I said, I want to open an account for Hamish. You can't, he's a cat. So I opened an account in my name with Hamish in brackets. And funnily enough, the next day, Susan McMullen, who wrote the book, did the same thing. She went in and wanted to open an account for him, and was told that there was one already there. Anyway, the account in the bank now has £1,276. Crowdfunding has £1,076 pledged. Now, that's remarkable because quite a few of the pledges are of £100 each, and one comes from Canada, and there's one pledge for £150, so it's quite extraordinary.
Are these from ex-students who've been here?
I have no idea. That's... I really don't know.
And so how much do you actually have to raise to get this project off the ground?
£5,000 for the statue, and another few thousand, I think, for the plinth. The plinth is actually, if it was going to be bronze, it would have been £3,000, and that's too much. So I've asked my favourite stone mason, Colin Sweeney, if he can find a recycled stone column somewhere, which wouldn't be very much. But considering David Annan's reputation, and I know what wonderful work he does, I think £5,000 is incredibly reasonable for a full-size bronze statue.
And do you think this is a good use of £5,000 for the town, or are there other things that £5,000 could do which would help people living in the town a lot more?
It's a good argument. I mean, obviously, people put their money where their heart is, and the enthusiasm for this statue has been quite remarkable. I agree with you. I mean, you know, it's a democracy. People can pay for what they want. And I think the statue will bring in tourism. It'll make a change from the university and the Gulf. And Greyfriars Bobby certainly is a very well visited tourist attraction. We want to put him in Church Square where everybody can see him.
Okay, that was, I was going to ask you where you wanted the statue to go, and are the council behind this? And
well, we have a sympathetic town planner who's given us some guidance, and I think they will agree to us putting it under the tree by the two seats so that people can't trip over it. That's the main consideration, I think.
And what does Hamish's official owner think of this project?
Oh, she's with us all the way. Marianne and Susan and David Annand and I walked about the town on in November to find out the best location. So we're all in it together.
We're hearing comparisons to Greyfriars Bobby. You mentioned it yourself. Is Hamish really that famous?
Difficult to judge. I think you'd have to have some kind of a questionnaire going out to see how many people agree or disagree. It would be fun to do. A nice project for somebody for their dissertation.
Do you think St Andrews is just trying to contrive a bit of a cuddly historical narrative to rival Edinburgh's here?
No, not at all. I mean, I'm responsible for this, so I take full responsibility. Nobody else has thought of it, and it seems to have caught on, though, which is nice.
Yeah, and what sort of reactions are you getting from people about the town? Is everyone really positive?
Yes, surprisingly enthusiastic. I think I've only had one dissenter who was a third-year student who thought I was wasting people's money. But as I said, people can put their money where they want to.
And what sort of timescale are we talking about for this to happen?
I hope very much it'll be up and running by next year. But, I mean, David Annand at the moment is making a full-size statue of Bishop Wardlaw for the university, which will be in St Mary's. So he's got that to do first.
Yeah,
he said it would take about a month to do.
Okay, so it's a fairly big project to make something like this. How do you go about making one of Hamish? Do you have to get him there and show him to the sculptor?
Well, the sculptor will look at him and measure him up, if you like. Because actually, you know, David Annand, I emailed him initially, not expecting an answer because he is famous. And I also thought that perhaps he would ask for some outrageous sum of money which nobody could afford. And I was astonished when I got an immediate reply saying, "I am a cat lover. Is this a May Coon?" And I'd never heard of that before, so I had to find out whether Hamish is a May Coon, but he's not.
He's not. What is a May Coon?
Apparently it's a pedigree cat. He's one of a litter which was quite ordinary, you know.
What do you think will happen in St Andrews when Hamish is there no more?
Well, this is why the statue is so important, as far as I can see, because once, I mean, if he died, say today, and there was nothing further, I think people would forget him, and it would be a great pity, after all these years.
And do you think that his memory will just vanish over time, or is the statue going to immortalise him and the legend will continue?
I hope so. I mean, Greyfriars Bobby, the legend is alive and well after, what, 100-and-something years?
120, 130 years, yeah. And you do think that he's got that wider reach and to keep going like that?
I hope so. I really do. Certainly in St Andrews, he will.
I suppose having students around the world helps that, and because we have a constant turnover of people in the town. Yeah. Is that a key factor?
I hope so, yeah. That's all I can say. I mean, no proof either way. Time will tell. That's the only thing I can think of.
We sound very excited about the project. Best of luck with it.
Thank you.
And do you want to once again just tell people how they can donate?
If you go to Google Bloom VC and then scroll along to Hamish's project, click on Hamish and follow instructions.
Flora?
There's just one other thing. Bloom VC only asks for money if the target is reached, and the target is unfortunately the 30th of March, so please hurry.
And what happens if we don't reach the 30th of March? Can you just extend the deadline for another time?
I'm not sure. I don't think so, because I think Bloom VC is very happy to change projects and keep going. So I think they're quite definite about the time. So.
Flora, thank you very much for coming in to talk to us. And as I say, best of luck with the project.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yesterday, a man set himself on fire in Bulgaria outside the presidential palace. This is the fourth time within a month that an incident like this has happened. The men are protesting against poverty, high fuel bills and corruption. In February, the Prime Minister resigned. After weeks of no government, a caretaker administration was announced on Tuesday. So what is going on in this EU member state? I'm joined by a Bulgarian student studying here at the University of St. Andrews, Georgi Valbanov. Welcome to the programme, Georgi.
Hello.
So the government resigned on February the 21st. Do you have any sense of what public opinion was like towards that government?
Before that, the nation was kind of polarized, I guess. There were people who liked the government because it was definitely doing more than all the governments before it. Managed to build quite a few highways and refurbish the capital. Also, the economy was stabilized quite well for the first time in many years. But I guess people still had quite a lot of problems with the fact that from an energy point of view, there were still a lot of problems, corruption, and there was basically...
But there was support for the government as well. It wasn't all negative.
No. There was support, but, you know, there were basically 1,000 people who protested, and they were enough.
So what do you think are the underlying causes of this economic unrest? Is there significant poverty among people?
I wouldn't say it's a significant poverty. It's just the fact that we are already in the European Union, so people expect things to get better and better faster than they are at the moment.
So you think this is partly down to expectations from the European Union, and if Bulgaria hadn't entered the European Union, then it actually would be in a better position in terms of stability?
I wouldn't say that. Stability and balance is one of the things the ex-prime minister, was talking about yesterday when he turned the government to the new one. He said that this government tried to work on everything at the same time, and with this it lost its stability. It couldn't really invest in everything, and that caused people to see that in a sense.
Thank you. I'll bring in at this point Christiana, who is also a Bulgarian student here at St. Andrews. Thank you for joining us as well. And so, do you have any sense, Georgi was just telling us about the underlying problems here and about how the country is divided. There are people both for and against the previous government. What do you think were the reactions of the public when the government resigned on February the 21st?
I think that it was definitely not something that the people expected. I think it was... there's a tendency in Bulgarian protesting in general, which we're not like very fruitful in, but there's a tendency, one of the things the slogans people say are often step down, and I don't think they ever expect that to actually happen. So I think it came as a bit of a surprise when the government actually did step down, overall, I think it was viewed in broadly two ways. I would say one was more of a, this is a part of the theater, you know, this is part of the political theater that GERB, the former ruling party, is used to. And the other one was they got scared. Or rather, they actually respect the public opinion, and like the two are, can be broadly then like separated into pro and cons, but I think broadly the first reaction was definitely surprise. I think no one saw that coming.
And do you think that now the second government is in place as of Tuesday, are they going to bring stability? Will they fare any better?
The interim government that just got announced by the president is a very peculiar combination of popular figures that kind of, I think, gain the trust of people, like Olympic champion Peter Stoichev, who's a swimmer, who's now the minister of sports and in youth.
Yeah,
and the an actor from a currently very famous Bulgarian TV crime TV series, who is now the Minister of Culture. And on the other side, I think you can see technocrats, so people like executive directors of banks, economists, Harvard graduates. So you can see kind of like, I think the president has tried to strike a balance between popular figures and technocrats in that sense. But the fact that, and also kind of like a mixture between political figures, so people with experience in politics and people with no experience in politics whatsoever. And the government has a potential, but I think they've set a very, very ambitious agenda for themselves, because as you know, the function of an interim government is normally just to assure fair elections. But I think this group of people has definitely aimed for something much bigger.
Georgie, do you agree with the sentiments there? Do you think that the government has set quite ambitious goals for itself?
I believe that this time it's quite different than any other time before that, because the people who are in the government, the new one, are not going to be centered around the self-interest of a party. Therefore, the kind of egoistic notion that every single other party has had so far, every single interest that has been the one which led to corruption, might be actually overcome in this short-lasting new government.
Of course, one of the things that the reason it is made up of all these random figures is because there's none of the political parties would actually take part in it. Is that healthy for a democracy?
Yes, that actually proves to be quite healthy, especially in the times we live in now. Democracy should be driven by the interest of what peoples need, not what government and the party in the truth wants for itself.
Again, there's a lot of technocrats in this government, as Christiana mentioned a few minutes ago. And the other example we've seen of a technocratic government in Europe, which was Mario Monti's in Italy, that's already gone. Do you think that this government will just last to the elections in May? Or, as some commentators have said, could it keep going afterwards until they can actually find a stable political government?
This cabinet currently doesn't have any future unless they amend the constitution, because as you might know, the election system in Bulgaria is mixed, so it's partly party elections and partly majoritarian elections, and currently unless all of these people run as independent candidates, but that will provide for only 50% of the people in parliament. They don't stand a chance. There has been a lot of talk in Bulgarian media and in social media that me and Georgi can feasibly see and monitor about introducing e-government principles, much like in Iceland. There has also been a lot of talks about introducing a full majority system, whereby we purely vote for faces, for candidates, as opposed to party line voting. And as such, as the constitution is now, this cabinet has no future, I think.
And another reason for this is that basically we've seen all the parties, the big ones that are on the market, so to say, at the moment, throughout the past 20 years, and all of them basically failed in one way or another. So the people of Bulgaria right now, they don't trust anybody with regards to political parties. And right now, probably the only way would be a full majority vote and just separate individuals who are going to work for the whole, rather than political parties working for themselves.
But there's one of the main technological problems with that is that this government has very, very little time until
That's
elections. So they don't even have the 100 days of confidence in the beginning to kind of take things in their hands. So in that sense, they have a very, very hard task in front of
So Bulgaria has come out of communism 20 years ago and is had some time in democracy. It's now an EU member state. Are they about to revolt, and are we about to see another system of government emerge?
Might be.
I'm quite interested that you've even accepted that as an answer at all. I expected that to be shot down quite quickly.
No, actually, I believe at the moment people were waking up, and the wave of protest, especially with the people who incinerated themselves, basically, I think it's a sign for a change. And Bulgaria might be the little country that nobody expected to emerge as something new, a new form of government. But that's only a... only an option.
I'm just not sure we have sufficient political will for a grand change. As I mentioned, I think there was major surprise when the citizens actually managed to induce real change in government. And perhaps as Georgi is saying, perhaps they might get, you know, like excited about their power.
Precisely, and that's why next time, if one of the same parties is elected, I think there are going to be another wave of protests and so on and so on. It's just going to keep going until a real change is induced. I think we are on the verge.
See, from the Western European perspective, the other thing that I'd like to bring in here is that the borders opened completely in January 2014 with Bulgaria and Romania. And at that point, I suppose you could describe them as being completely integrated within the EU. Do you think Brussels will allow too much change, too much instability, too much experimentation with politics in Bulgaria?
Well, provided the instability that's lasted until now, basically, I think that would be the best option.
Also, the EU has so far absolutely proven that as far as latest members accepted go, they care much more about economic stability than anything else, and about economic achievements. So in that sense, I think for the countries accepted in 2007 and the previous batch as well, to some extent, membership in the EU does not... The EU has remained an economic union, whereas I think it's mostly in Western Europe that the EU has actually become the political union that it's intended to be now.
See, actually, again, that's interesting because in particular in Britain and in this part of Western Europe, what we're seeing is a backlash and people wanting the economic union and far less of the political union. Is it the opposite in Bulgaria?
I would say that back when we got accepted in the EU, it was definitely a will for political union. It was definitely and cultural union for that matter. And somehow we were struggling to get beyond the economic threshold. And then by now, I think people see the economic benefits of being in the EU. Perhaps the economic benefits of not being in the Eurozone. But Bulgarians in general, I think, if I can claim anything like that, but I think are rather disillusioned with the idea of the membership of the EU as bringing anything in particular. I think it was a political move for us in the very beginning, and it continues to be a matter of politics as opposed to any much else.
Communist Bulgaria is, of course, before your time. But how far in your lifetime have you seen things change in the country, for better or for worse?
All the time.
Is it really noticeable how different things are from when you were younger?
Yes. Every 5 years you can see dramatic change in Bulgaria with regards to probably every aspect that I can think of. Well, of course, there are some things such as occasional corruption going on here and there, but indeed there are times have been much better since what happened like 20 or so years ago.
So is this the first negative change we're seeing? Has it been positive up till now?
I wouldn't say it's a negative change at all.
Okay.
I would say that's one of the most positive changes that happened to Bulgaria in quite a while.
I think it's change, and that's what counts.
Yeah.
Because like, I don't know, I have the feeling that Bulgarian history has proven that we're not very keen on change and we're not very excited about it. And also we rarely, I think with all the regime changes that we have actually undergone through, we rarely ever adopt passionately or stand passionately behind a regime or an idea. So as much as the communist government in Bulgaria, very maybe peculiarly and interestingly, communist government was produced after a revolt from the inside as opposed to occupation from the outside. And the same happened with the democratic government. It was, it was correlation to the collapse of USSR, but still it was an inside process, but still never, I don't think that the public ever embraced fully or was very passionate about any certain political idea. So we need, we just need more active citizenship and more civil consciousness, I think.
So from this current situation of instability, which is, you know, particularly extreme in Bulgaria at the moment, but there is obviously instability across the whole of Europe and in many ways across a large section of the world. Where do you see the country in 5-10 years' time being?
That's a difficult one, I guess. Well, depending on the unfolding of events in the next few months, I guess things can go either very good or very bad for Bulgaria. And if we're being optimists, then I believe the financial stability of the country at the moment, which is one of the best actually in the whole European Union, it's going to provide a basis for experimentation with regards to our government. And if those experiments prove successful, then we might have a revolution in Bulgaria, which would be for the better.
Christiana, a revolution, what do you think?
I have to say I'm a bit pessimistic about what's going to happen now, just now. I'm quite afraid. I'm afraid I can't speak about a longer term future. I'm quite afraid that the immediate outcome of these elections is going to be a re-election of GERB, the former party in government. And from then on, in my head, it all goes down. But I admit, I admit that there is the opportunity for a fundamental change, as I said, a constitutional change, and electoral change. And then from then on, I think I wouldn't see it as much as a revolution as a gradual building up of more technocrat, more less lucrative governments, hopefully.
Christiana, Georgie, thank you both to you for joining us here in the studio today. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
And this is the last edition of Alexander Jones Live before the holidays, which means that we will be back on the 4th of April. We'll be back at 5 p.m. on Thursday, the 4th of April. Till then, you can listen to this programme again online on the Star website. It'll be available as a podcast in a short while. And remember, you can get the latest from Star News on our website 24 hours a day. I'm Alexander Jones. Thank you very much for listening. As I say, I'll be back on April the 4th. Have a good holiday and enjoy the rest of your night.
Tune in to Star, University of St. Andrews radio station.
St. Andrews' only radio station.
This is Star.
Contact us here at the studio by buzzing the studio from www.standrewsradio.com.